Today is Monday, February 29th, 2016. This is interviewer Lynn Downey. I'm speaking with
Anthony Edward Melendez, known as Tony Melendez.
And what is your address?
990 South Kellis, Wickenburg, Arizona.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. I want to start at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your background. Where were you born?
I was born actually in Los Angeles, California in 1948. And I spent my summers here with my grandfather and my parents at the Monta Vista Guest Ranch. He was a caretaker of the ranch. And when I was entered into the fourth grade is when I moved here and stayed with my grandfather. And then my parents moved over shortly thereafter.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. That must have been quite a change. What did you see? What kind of a shock was it to be in Wickenburg, even though you'd been visiting for so long?
It wasn't a shock. I mean, we were shown Wickenburg at an early age, and we immediately fell in love with it. I mean, for two boys, my brother and I, plus I had some younger sisters, this was our Disneyland.
Yeah. That's lovely. Tell me about the ranch in those days.
The Monta Vista, you know, was basically our ranch, especially during the summer when everybody was gone, and we had free reign of the ranch itself, the stables, the swimming pool, the cafeteria where they'd have meals prepared. And of course, we had access to the kitchen and the freezer, and so we did quite well there.
Oh, what fun!
Yes, definitely. We also worked too. I remember, painting the main dining room area. With the stain, I want to say red color, and we would paint it on there, and that's what we do during the summer. And our reward for that was be able to get into the freezers where the drumsticks were. I mean, ice cream drumsticks.
Who were the owners of the Monta Vista at that time?
At that time, it was Carl Bylan and Victoria. Or Veronica was her name.
What were they like?
They were great. He was a very boisterous individual and smoked a lot of cigars. I remember that.
Yeah. Do you remember a lot of the visitors that came?
No, not the visitors per se. Basically, like I said, we were there during the summer months that we'd have that. And then right about the time my grandfather was transitioning to work at the school as a school bus driver, this was probably 1952, 1953. And then that's when we started living in town.
Where did you live?
Right off of, by the high school, off South Tegner, right? We were on the corner lot by the old high school, right across the street from the old pool hall that they had there.
Oh, what's there now?
It's still there. I don't know who has control of the building. It's a two-story building. But when I was growing up, it was Jess Davis. His son, Harold, ran the pool hall there. And my grandfather would take us over there in the evenings from time to time. And we would play some pool, and then we'd go back to the house across the street.
Tell me a little more about your parents and your grandparents.
My grandparents, Joe Campo and his wife and my grandmother, Jessie, were, married in California. They came probably in the late 40s. My grandfather was dealing with asthma. And as he says it, he was dying. And they literally brought him up here on his deathbed. And within 2 weeks, he was back on his feet and functioning well. So he was meant to stay here.
Wow. What part of California were the Ocampos from?
They were from here. They went to California around the Los Angeles area down in there and, working around Monterey Park in that area, but mainly in the East L.A. area.
And tell me about a little about your grandmother.
My grandmother was from California also, and her parents grew up, she was born in Jerome, and they spent some time in Wickenburg. They ended up in California. My grandfather and her married there, came here. They did divorce, and my second grandmother, whose name was Jessie, came over, and that's who he was here at the Monta Vista and in the Wickenburg area.
Oh. What were the two grandmothers' maiden names?
Was Pedra, I believe, and the other one was Melendez.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how about your mom and dad?
No, I take that back. My grandmother's name, my second grandmother's name was not Melendez, but I'm going to have to pull that up for you.
Okay.
You know, because I just remembered her as, you know, in those days as, you know, Ocampo.
Yeah.
Do that.
Yeah. Tell me about your mom and dad.
My mom and dad, Gilbert Melendez, and my mother, Lupe Melendez. And she was my grandfather's daughter, youngest daughter. Mm-hmm. And they were great parents. My mother was very a typical mother to the extent that she raised me to always work on my manners, always open the doors, always be protective of the family, and showed me a lot of the family values that I still have, and I'm hoping to transition that, and I have to my kids and also my grandkids. Yes, she was definitely, I was mama's boy, there's no question, you know.
Where did you go to school when you started going to school in town?
I went here at the Garcia School, mm-hmm. went there, started fourth grade there with Mrs. Warden's class. I then had Mrs. Jones in the fifth grade, and then Mr. Labrantino, I believe, in the sixth grade. And then that's when I had a break, and the family decided, my parents had moved back to California, and Joe T., my grandfather, thought it'd be a good experience for me to go there and get used to that shock of going to a school where there was a lot of kids. And that was definitely a shock. And that lasted 1 year. And then I came right back with my grandfather.
Wow. How many kids were in your class at the Garcia School?
At the Garcia School, I want to say probably at the very most 20, if that.
Wow.
You know.
Did you, when you were going to school there, did you have a sense of how historic the building was and what the story of the building was and who Mr. Garcia was?
Yes, I definitely did that. And the other thing, too, is the building itself. Because, well, we didn't go, I was in, never had anything in the Red Schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. Ours was behind it in some, I believe they were some military buildings that they took over. And they had their, the schoolhouse was Red House. The Red Schoolhouse was here. Our classroom was down here, the fourth grade. Then we had a big ball field there along Saul's Wash. And then there was two more military buildings, I believe, here. And this was the fifth grade. That's where we went. And we would play softball there. Then right across the street, or behind that, was Prescott Street. And that's where my family lived. And that right now is where they have the police station, the lumber yard in that area through there.
No kidding. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was called Prescott Street at that time. And then the lumber yard was there and our houses were there. And there was Prescott with dead end there at Saul's Wash. And then our families lived in that area through there. And right behind it was the ball field of the schools that we'd go to. Then right across, we'd cross the wash there to go to Coffinger Park. And that was the focal point for us, especially during the summer, because that's where we played Little League and we had swimming pool there.
When did those buildings all go away? Do you remember?
The majority of those buildings went away probably in, I would say, probably mid-60s. And the last part of it went away when probably about 97 when they built the new pool. They got rid of the old pool and then they took, they used to have a rec building there. And right now there's a playground there, and right, and then there's a cabana, and right where the playground is to the north of that is where they had the old rec building there. And that was really a heavy area with mesquite trees. All that area was mesquite trees back in my day, and that's where we used to spend our days.
Wow.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And there was a lot of history, and that's where I, you know, I can deviate from when I grew up and then also what my grandfather and the family had shown me. And then plus my grandfather's father's house was on the corner there, and it was still there. And I think when they started building bashes and those stores there, they knocked those buildings down. And then also when Garcia's school caught on fire, they knocked those buildings down. And all they maintained was the little red school house.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
So then you went to the old high school for high school.
Right off of Tegner, South Tegner. Went there. And then went there my freshman year, and then there was that break again where my family thought it would be very good for me to be experience the high school aspect. Plus, I think my mom and dad wanted, you know, to have some control of me, you know, rather than my grandfather. And I think because they wanted to just have me there. So I went back there, and believe me, that was a shock, because you figure there was probably maybe 40 kids in our class, and I went into a high school that had a population of 5,000 to 8,000. And it was definitely a shock for me. There, I went to Mark Keppel in San Gabriel, that area. And then that lasted for a year. Then I came back. And I said, kept on coming back. My brother stayed the whole time there because he was the oldest one. But I came back in 1964 and then went to high school and finished it out through there.
So you really, it was... Your grandfather's sort of, you had a lot of influence from your grandfather.
My grandfather was basically the one that actually raised me, you know, because he took ownership of Gilbert and I when we were young, and it stayed like that all the way through. And, you know, he had a lot of grandkids, and I'm not saying his other grandkids were as precious to him as Gilbert and I were, but somehow I think Gilbert and I had a good relationship with him. And then he basically, you know, helped us through life, you know, guiding us and using his ways.
Wow. Were there a lot of other Hispanic families in your school or in your neighborhood? Or?
Yes. I mean, there were the Jaimes, the Garcias, you know, the Herskowitzes. There was a lot of other families there. But, you know, in those days, we didn't think of any of that. We were just kids growing up. And these were kids that we grew up with from the fourth grade all the way through high school. And they're still close friends. And then the benefit that my generation had is that Wickenburg at that time was what I consider a whole community. And for us to venture to Glendale or Phoenix, that was a planned trip. And that would take a whole, you know, day. And mainly into Glendale because that was the closest. And so we stayed in Wickenburg. And we had, you know, this was, to me, the center of the world right here in Wickenburg. And what made it unique for us is that the other communities that we played against in sports were like Baghdad, Gila Bend, and those communities, especially Baghdad. We grew up with those kids, playing the same kids we played in the fourth grade all the way through high school. And that was unique. And, you know, Wickenburg, like I said, was the center of the universe, and everything that we did was in the town of Wickenburg. And, you know, that to me was, I think, my generation was the last one to have Wickenburg that way.
Wow. What kind of recreation activities did you have besides sports? Was the movie theater? Yeah, the movie theater?
Yes, definitely. That was there since, I think, 1948. That was always there, of course. We had a lot of, you know, spent a lot of time in the desert, Box Canyon, all the places they go to now. But it was basically, you know, I was telling my grandkids, up here at Turtleback, we could disappear on a Saturday, spend the night up there, come back, and nobody would even question, you know, what's going on, where are you at? The parents would give us free rein to do that. We would do that. You know, we could do it in those days. You know, we would spend a lot of time. It all depends on the season. I know we'd get, we'd start using that Yankee ingenuity to go get during the Christmas break, we'd go down the Hacienda and get some mistletoe off the old cottonwood trees and come up by the Western Auto Store. Well, I call it the Western Auto Store now, but that's where Chaparral used to be. That was the Western Auto Store there. And we would sit there. There was a rail there, and there was always a lot of older men sitting there. And, you know, we'd have to basically bump them out to sell our mistletoe. And that's how we'd get our money. And then plus, we'd collect bottles and then take them down to Brayton's, or not Brayton's, but Brian's store there at the corner where the new ranch has their office, the Wickenburg Inn Ranch has their office there. It used to be a grocery store there. And we'd take our bottles there and we'd get our change to get our ice creams or whatever we wanted to do to spend the day. And that's how we would, you know, just go all over town, you know, go underneath the bridge, the old bridge. And one of the things we used to do was crawl underneath it and walk the rail all the way across. Other times they'd get adventurous and actually get in the sewer system there and come all the way to Center and Tegner and be looking at the intersection there and not thinking of anything about that. I remember growing up when they went, we had this the new underpass, they added this additional lanes because it used to be just a two-laner, and then they opened up the, I would say probably the, that would be the east lane, and they knocked a piece of the concrete down, and it must have been probably a 50-foot slab by 50-foot, and us kids would get in there and start tunneling underneath it. And then I think finally the construction people thought, we better fence this off before something happens to these kids, and they fenced it off, you know. And then the other things we would do is that the slow trains, they'd always come, because after my grandfather had several places in Wickenburg, and one of the places he has is right on the corner by Woody, where he has his old gasoline tanks and warehouse right there. His house was right in that area. But we'd go by the by where the Hacienda, or not, by Brayton's, we'd get across there and wait for the train to come by at about 5 o'clock every evening. And it slowed down, and we'd jump on it and ride it to right to the curve going up by towards Google's. And there was a big pile of sand, and we'd jump off there. And that's things we would do for excitement, you know. So that was, you know, that was our time. That was probably in the late 50s.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, good thing it was your grandfather, not your mother.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So, yeah.
Tell me about Brayton's. What was it like inside there?
It was great. I remember going there and walking around, looking inside the store. I remember going there and buying Wrangler Levi's. And I liked Wranglers back in those days because they had the deep pockets. And plus, they were cheaper than the Levi's. And I think they were like $4 or $5 for a pair to go in there. And you'd see the store there, you know, you'd see it, but you really not, you wouldn't think of the history. I did remember going outside and see there was a gas pump there. And I was amazed how they would do that, that they would literally pump the gallons up on top through a glass ball that you could see and be like 5 gallons, and they'd come back and then they'd fill it up. And that's, I remember seeing that. And that was a great store there at that time. I remember that. And also, right out of high school, I started working at the Standard Station where the museum is now. And that was a high dollar back in those days because we didn't work on commissions, but they were giving us, I think, almost $5 an hour, which was unheard of in those days. And I was working there. And right behind the gas station there, there was the old opera house. You can see I have a photograph here showing that's the old opera house there. It used to be facing on Tegner. You know, but they moved it, and I forget when they moved it. It was, you know, there, probably before my time. And at that time, there was an art gallery in it. And I remember going into that building up on top, and there was a lot of newspapers in there that had, you know, the end of World War II, 1945, all the ceremonies that were going on through that were, you know, just thrown all over the place up on top.
Did you know a lot of people who went away to World War II? Did that have a big effect on the town?
Oh, yes, definitely so. I mean, you know, especially now as I get older, looking at all the people that were, you know, what I consider older men, much older, you know, because at that time I didn't have a time and distance and you know, knowing, you know, somebody's in their 20s to me, they were old, somebody in their 30s, they were history. But these were definitely, you know, I want to use the term, they were our rock stars back then, because these are guys that were just down to earth, but when you read about what they did in the service, and it was just amazing. And I mean, I was in Vietnam in 1969 to 70 with the 9th Infantry Division, but to me, those men were in war. I mean, day in and day out, and for years at a time, and the things that they had to deal with, and the whole society had to deal with that, and then come back and function after that. You know, I know my father-in-law, Mitch Kirkus, his brother Tommy was killed in the Pacific, you know, towards the end of the war, you know, and just, you know, listening to the stories and just watching that, and then they come back and you see them, just their day-to-day lives, and you wonder, mercy, they were all in the one branch of the service, you know, and it's just totally amazing how much history was there with that.
Yeah. When you were in school or when you were just talking with other people in town, did people talk about Wickenburg history? Did they talk about Henry Wickenburg? Was there a sense of how old Wickenburg really was?
Not at that time. You know, I remember the closest thing that always flashed up would be the Google house. George Google and Mrs. Google. Her name was Ann Google. And in fact, when I got older, when I came back as chief of police, I'd see her. She says, you know, call me Ann. I said, Mrs. Google, I can't. I says, I was in that generation. I can't call you Mrs. I can't call you Ann. I have to call you Mrs. Google. And she agreed with that. But her house was down at the end of South Tegner towards Simpsons, down on the right-hand side there. And we'd spent a lot of time down there, you know, with the Googles and down South Tegner. We would go to the old girls' gym, which is still there at the... I guess they call it the Hacienda School, right there. The girls' gym is still there, and I think that was built probably in the 20s. But we'd go in there and we'd use that for, you know, recreation and, you know, basketball tournaments and things like that. We'd spend a lot of time there, and there was a big ball field there too, and we'd go there.
Seems like there was a lot of thought put into stuff for kids to do.
You know, I think, you know, a lot of people would complain, but you know what? I think we created a lot of the activities for ourselves based on our environment. You know, even kids nowadays, you take them to Disneyland within 10, 15 minutes, they're bored, they want to see. And we created our own, you know, things to do in Wickenburg. There was always something going on, you know, and that was it. We never thought about, you know, I want to get out of here. To me, like I said, had it not been for the military, and yes, I did come back, to me, Wickenburg was a center of the universe. And when Uncle Sam got a hold of me, they cut that umbilical cord. Mm-hmm. And I went out, came back, and then I knew that there was another part of society out there that was, you know, was ready to go. But I used to have, you know, when I was in California during my younger years, that's all, I couldn't wait to go to bed so I could dream that I was back in Wickenburg, if that makes sense. I mean, I missed it that much.
Wow.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a bit about that. So what did you do when you finished high school?
When I finished high school, I came out of high school. I started working at the Standard Station there, and I was going to Glendale Community College. And I was just carrying, you know, basic hours in through there. And did that for about a year and a half. I went to California briefly right after graduation with the family. Then I told them that, no, I'm coming back to Arizona. And I was employed there at the Standard Station. It was a company-owned station. Went there and did that for about a year and a half. Then Uncle Sam sent me a card saying, greetings, you are now inducted into the armed services. And I went in to the service. I spent my basic training up at Fort Lewis, Washington, which was coming from the desert to there was, I fell in love, especially when they would say, we're going out for a 10-mile hike out in the forest. To me, I enjoyed that because living in the desert like that, and plus with my grandfather and all my friends, we lived on the desert. We understood the outdoor life. We knew how to camp. We knew how to take care of ourselves, how to survive. And that played well into my service years. There, I was at Fort Lewis. Then after that, I went to Fort Ord, California for advanced training. And at that time, since I was drafted, they could do what they want with me. And they made me into a radio operator and also a lineman. And that's where I went to there. And after that, I was sent to Fort Carson, Colorado with the 5th Mechanized Division. And I was there for, you know, the remainder of that year. And then following that, I was sent to Vietnam in 1969, and I stayed there through 1970, March.
Where in Vietnam were you?
I was in Dong Tam in the Delta. Mm-hmm. I was with the 9th Infantry Division. That was kind of interesting because a lot of friends that I grew up here in Wickenburg served in Vietnam, and a lot of them didn't come back. One of them that I don't know if I could share the story, but it was Donnie Davis. He died over in Vietnam, and it was one of those things. We went together in the service. We were inducted. We went to Phoenix, induction center there. We went through the process. We went to Fort Lewis. They tested us. They came back and said, you know, you guys qualified to go to officer candidate school. You can go special forces. You can do these other things, but you'll have to enlist for one more year rather than a 2 year. And for whatever reason in my head, I said, no, I'm just going to do my 2 years. And Donnie said, no, I'm going to do 3. He says, that way I'll be too short to go to Vietnam, Tony, because they guarantee us the training here, then 18 months of training, and then we'll be too short to go to Vietnam. And I said, no, Donnie, we're going to Vietnam. That's no ifs, ands, or buts, because my brother Gilbert had just came back from Vietnam. And so came back, and I went and did my thing. Donnie went back, I think, Georgia, someplace there. And he did have 18 months of training. I went through mine. I went to Vietnam, came back, and Donnie was going over. And I think within 4 months, he was killed in Vietnam. And it just, I asked myself, you know, had we just stayed that course? But you don't know what history's going to give you. But I was very fortunate in the service that I was with the infrared sniper team. And we'd go set up night ambushes. We were a special unit, and we were called upon by the, you know, special forces, the Arvins, anybody, the Navy, anybody that needed. We had infrared capability where we could see at night, and we'd switch over to white light, and then we found some activity, and we would, you know, spend our time doing that, and we'd probably go out in the field every for 2 weeks at a time. And then came back.
Wow. Do you feel, did you feel that you took Wickenburg with you when you went to Vietnam?
There's no doubt, because I did get a lot of, mail from Wickenburg, that part there. Especially when we'd go set up night ambushes, me and my partner, was a two-man team. And when we felt secure and everything, which was, quite a bit of the time, we would share stories. And I think they heard every story I had growing up in Wickenburg, and everybody knew Wickenburg, because that was one thing I used all the time, was Wickenburg. And they always say that, Tony, yeah, he's from Wickenburg, he's Arizona. And so, yeah, they knew, because I was very proud, and I had a lot of stories to tell about what we did in Wickenburg.
Did you ever meet or hang out with other men from other parts of Arizona?
I ran into a couple of kids that I was in school with there in Vietnam, that we looked each other up and we ran into each other there. I remember coming home, and I think we landed at Wake Island, and Sandra Gibson at that time, which is Hartman now, was working at the airlines, and I was coming off a plane. She was going on another plane. She looked at me and says, Gilbert. And I said, no, I'm Tony, And so just waving at each other, went through there, yes.
Wow.
But you realize it is a small world.
I want to backtrack a little bit and ask you a question I forgot. Did your family go to church? And if so, which church did you go to?
Yes, the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. So right there on St. Anthony's.
Mm-hmm. Was that a big part of your life, or was it?
Yes, it was. It was, part of our, culture and part of our life there. The time that I did go to California, that my parents had me in a Catholic school. So that was definitely that I had to go through. When I came back, and I was part of, my brother was an altar boy, but I never became an altar boy.
Did you get teased at all in the big school in California for being like the kid from Arizona? Did that ever happen?
No, not really. I know it saved me one time. I was, my cousin had a party, and it was at a wedding, and my mother was there, and she says, whatever you do, don't go outside, because there's a lot of rough people out there. And I said, I didn't have a clue. And I went outside. I was circled by this group of guys. And they asked me where I was from. And I said, I was from Arizona. And started talking to them, came back, had a good time. My uncle went and got me, brought me back in. He says, I just wanted to make sure you stay away from those guys. I says, well, they're good to me. He says, well, that's the Arizona gang. And I says, okay, because they lived on Arizona Street. And I said, well, I think I scored, because I told them I was from Arizona, and they said, Arizona the state. They said, the street? No, I said, Arizona the state. And so I think that's why they treated me nice.
That's hilarious.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that vividly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Tell me a little more about some of your classmates that you remember, or and maybe some of your teachers too, either your grammar school or high school years.
Well, I remember, you know, all my teachers, as we, you know, that was, you know, like I said, they were our rock stars. And some of them I did not have as a teacher, but I had them in different sports that we had there. Mm-hmm. I had like Mrs. Warden, who was a fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Jones, I think, whoever, my generation, everybody had Mrs. Jones, a fifth grade teacher. Mrs. Thompson, I remember her quite well. Mr. Laventino, Mr. Bachtel, Mr. Fries, Mr. Kerr. And there was a, those were the grade school people that, you know, bolded us and showed us, you know, what to do. And then in high school, we, of course, we had, I was very fortunate that I had a coach like Coach Ralph Moran, who I think, to me, shaped me a lot. Too, as to, you know, help me to become the person I am today, which I think, you know, I owe him a lot for, you know, helping me at different times in my life when I thought I was by myself, and he was there. He was quite the man. I think he affected a lot of, I know he did my brother the same way too. Mr. Gladden, Mr. Cook, who was the principal at that time up here. And there was, like I said, there was so many teachers that, you know, Mrs. Vineyard, I had hers, you know, in English. And, you know, there was just a lot of, you know, teachers that really made an impact on us. And, you know, and the thing is they knew us so well that we couldn't, you know, do anything, you know, because we were small in numbers and they knew our personalities. Mrs. Hawkins was that way too, you know, because not only that, she says, you know, they knew our parents, grandparents, and, you know, so we couldn't get away with anything. In those days, they said, y'all tell your parents, you know, that kept us in those white lines, yes.
Wow. What was, do you happen to know what the population of Wickenburg was when you were growing up?
At that time, probably about, you know, 400, 500. I remember things that we used to do would be like, you know, the street dances for football games, where they'd literally, we'd take over the downtown area and we'd meet there at the high school. The cheerleaders would take us around and we'd go to different intersections. We'd stop traffic and make a big circle. They would do some cheers, and we'd run to the next intersection. It was just, you know, like downtown Wickenburg there at Wickenburg Way and Tegner stopped there. Then we'd run up to the Yavapai. Then we'd go back around off of Valentine and then come back and end at the high school, and they'd have a bonfire or something like that. And that was generally like, you know, at homecoming and special games that they would do. And those, you know, that's the things we did. When we had tournaments, I mean, everybody came to the ball games because that was the other thing the families did. I mean, the stadiums would be packed because, you know, that's what that was a big event for Wickenburg on a Friday or even a, you know, Tuesday night or Thursday night when there was basketball games. And then baseball, you know, that was the same thing too. You always had this sport. In those days, all us kids played all the sports.
Mm-hmm. What about the girls? What did the girls do for fun in town? Do you know?
No, a lot of them would basically stay home a lot because it was just, you know, us boys would be around town. Very seldom would you see them around town unless it was some type of social event. But I remember the main thing is like at football practice, a lot of the girls would be working their cheers and things like that. And I remember them coming down. They always had these big old rollers on their heads and scarves on their heads, and they'd be out there practicing how to, you know, cheer. And we'd be playing football. Then we would go, you know, the game. Then after the game, there was always a dance there at the high school. I remember going to the show. The show was unbelievable in those days because I think when I first started there, it was like 25 cents, 75 cents to go in. We'd go right next to, I think it's called the Wagon Wheel, which was Jean's Cafe back in those days. And in those days, you could go over there, get an order of fries and a Coke for a quarter. You know, fries were 15 cents and the Coke was 10. You know, so things were good. With the pool, we'd go to the pool, and to get into the pool, it was 10 cents. And, you know, and that was my generation, much less the other generation, you know, ahead of us with the prices. So there was always something going on and always something to do in Wickenburg. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, and us kids, we had a ball. We had a ball. We didn't cause any problems. You know, I don't ever think of ever having a police officer come and say, you know, hey, you know, sometimes I know when we were getting close to curfew, they'd say, hey, get, you know, Mr. Carl Miller and them would say, hey, time to get home. Yes, sir, we'd go home, and we knew when to be home.
So you're finished in Vietnam, and you've come back. Do you come back to Wickenburg?
I came back to Wickenburg, went back to the service station, and I started going to Glendale Community College. And then that's when the Department of Public Safety, the Highway Patrol, the officers would come in there. And they'd say, you know, you ought to be a police officer. And, you know, I says, you know, I've always found myself getting involved and helping other people, you know. And I thought, you know, that might be a good, you know, gig. And so I went and applied. I was successful. But then I decided, you know what, I just got out of a military structure. I wanted to have a little time to play. And so I came back and I did that for about 6 months, and I decided, no, I need to get in with the department. And I did. I was very fortunate. Most people have a process of a year or so to get in. I think I started mine within 30 days. I was in an academy going there in Phoenix. And that was back in 1972. Mm-hmm. I came home in 1970, and then I went to the academy in 1972.
Wow. So what happened next?
After that, I came back on. They sent me to San Manuel, which was sort of, I feel they put me to sleep there. They said that it's an area you're going to love. There's no sergeants there. It's a two-man station, and you won't have no supervision because we think you can take care of yourself and you don't need that supervision. We're going to put you there. And so I went through there on my OJT. It was always at night.
What's OJT?
Field officer training, part of it. And I went there at night, like I said, it was like Baghdad is a mining town. And then when I finally went there in the daylight, I said, oh mercy, what I get myself into. But it was a good, place. Our booking was in Tucson, and I was there for about a year. And then they sent me to Aguila, and I was stationed in Aguila for about, 6 months. And then they moved me into Wickenburg. And Wickenburg in those days, believe it or not, and they, to this present day, has a soft spot with command-level people at DPS, because that's where a lot of them started out. And everybody knew that if you were given Wickenburg, you they were taking care of you. And so I really felt good about that. And then I was here at Wickenburg for probably less than 4 months. And then I heard about a governor's detail where Governor Castro was now the governor of Arizona. And I had met Governor Castro briefly at my grandfather's house where Mr. Ashurst, he was a judge here, was our next door neighbor, and he came over and he introduced Governor Castro to my grandfather and wanted my grandfather to help him, with some political support. And that's when I met Governor Castro. And he wasn't successful that time, but the next time he was and became governor. And so I went down and, applied through DPS, and I was successful. And I was on the road for a year and a half, and then from there they sent me to governor's detail. And I was a governor's bodyguard. I went through three governors, started with Governor Castro, who was appointed by Jimmy Carter. And I had a heck of an experience with him and Jimmy Carter, President Carter.
Tell me.
Governor Castro, he once again knew all about me because of Wickenburg, and always telling me about Wickenburg. And we'd get to go to Washington, we'd go wherever he went, and it was always with him. If I would have went with Secret Service, I'd always been given the responsibility of guarding the limo in the garage overnight. But with the governor, you're right there with him. If he goes to the White House, you go to the White House. If he goes wherever he goes, you go as the body man. So he'd say, okay, who hasn't been to Washington? And they said, well, Tony hasn't gone. Well, I'll take Tony with me. And we'd go there, and he knew everybody there. And, I mean, he would go out of his way to introduce me. He'd say, Governor Castro, how are you doing? And they said, yeah, this is my aide, Tony Melendez. And he had introduced me to, Senator Humphrey, just all these people that I saw, the Onassis, just these, the Kennedys, everybody that I saw growing up. And there they are in front of me in this room, because he was a Democrat. And he would take me. I remember going to the Time and Life building in New York. It was during the Democratic National Convention. And we went into this function there. And, I mean, Jackie Onassis was there. the Kennedys and all these people that I saw, Muhammad Ali, Howard Cosell, all these people are in there. And as we're going up in the elevator, the governor says, Tony, don't embarrass me here because you're from Wickenburg. And I said, no, sir, I won't. So then I'm over there with watching the governor. He's doing this other stuff. And I look over to the side there, and I see a man there that I know from Wickenburg. His name was Peter Winterbolt. His family was from here. And he was a reporter for Time Life. And he ended up being a pastor. And then I think he's in South America someplace. I lost track of him. But he was there. And he saw me. And once again, Gilbert. I said, no, I'm Tony. Came over. We started talking. And I said, well, you got to come with me. And I went, Governor, you're not going to believe this. I said, but he was another kid from Wickenburg. And he started laughing. So, well, we better get out of this building because something's going to happen, you know. So we came back down and we, you know, came from there. But one thing about Governor Castro, he always, you know, took care of me and everybody else on the detail. And especially we'd go to Mexico and they would think I was his son. And, you know, and there was customary for them to give gifts. They see me, here's gift. I said, no, I can't, I'm the bodyguard, you know. And so we'd go from there. But I mean, a lot of the stuff we saw was firsthand. And once again, coming from small town in Wickenburg, traveling all over the country, and it's just amazing. And then after that, I had Governor Bolden, which was interesting too. I was with him only for 4 months. Then he passed away. He died of a heart attack. And but he was unique in his way with his man. And thing about that, I remember, and he remembered too, because he was Secretary of State, because I was working here as a new patrolman, and I stopped this individual going by Morristown, above the posted speed limit, about, you know, 15 miles an hour. And I stopped him, and he, you know, filled out his name. Yes, sir, I'm just going to give you a warning, you know, this and that. Left him, but the name, Wesley Bolden. Why do I know this name, Wesley Bolden? I go in there and I ask my sergeant, who's Wesley Bolden? He's the one that signs your check. You know? And I said, well, I just stopped him. You know, but, you know, I gave him a warning. And he says, okay. But he remembered that when I went up there. I said, Governor Bolden, oh, I remember you, the way you talk. You're that officer that stopped me at Morristown. I said, yes, sir, I am. But he was just a kind man, very nice. And we, like I said, 4 months with him, then he passed. Also, between that time, too, I became sort of friends with Bruce Babbitt. We'd meet in the elevator going back up. Then we're always talking about snow skiing and hiking and all this other stuff there. And then when Governor Bolden died, obviously, because he was the attorney general, and the way it came down in secession, he was the next governor. He didn't have to run for governor. He just woke up one day, he was the governor. And then I went to pick him up, and there was, you know, by that time, there was at least almost a half or about a dozen of us on the governor's detail. And so we, you know, took responsibility of the governor, his family, and everything. And so we would go with him. And it was kind of unique because with Governor Castro, we would do the banquets and the dinners and the circuits. So needless to say, I gained about 20 pounds doing all that. It's the same thing with Governor Bolden. That's all he did is go to these dinners. Governor Babbitt was a different one where he'd climb Squaw Peak. He would run, you know, back and forth through all these other things, run marathons and, you know, 5Ks. So we started doing that. And right away just knocked us right down. And it was, you know, we had to change we had a Cadillac limo. We had to end up getting a Suburban four-wheel drive and do that. But I was with him for 6 years. And I said, hey, you become part of the family. And I mean, he also treated me quite well. And he became part of the family, too. In fact, my grandfather, Joe T., when he was Grand Marshal here for the Gold Rush Parade, Governor Babbitt came here and rode with him in the car like that. Him and my grandfather would talk in Spanish, and they would have a good time. And, you know, because he would refer to him as Preto, which means dark. And so that was his name there, and we'd talk and stuff like that. So he was very good to my family, and we came. And then plus, you know, with his kids and everything, Christopher and TJ and Mrs. Babbitt was another one. Mrs. Babbitt was my age. And then afterwards, when I became chief here, I ran into her. Tony, call me Hattie. I said, I can't. I'm sorry. We're the same age. I said, I know, but I just can't do that. I have to call you Mrs. Babbitt, you know, and that's what we did there. But with Governor Babbitt, you know, what was neat about him is one day you'd be at the White House, next day you'd be hiking the Grand Canyon. Once again, you'd be, you know, Hawaii, you'd go to Robert Redford's place and, you know, at Sundance and ski there. And that was another thing that I was very fortunate that my skiing, Mrs. Babbitt always said, Tony learned how to ski in 8 minutes. And it was because everywhere we went skiing, they'd always give him a ski instructor pro of that hill. And of course, when they worked with the governor, since I was there and Bo was there, whoever was there, their ability came up to well. And so therefore, and it was, you know, part of the job. So we did it. So definitely. But it was kind of unique going into, you know, like Robert Redford, going to his house, thinking about him last night at the Academy Awards, because I remember at his house in there at Sundance, he has this big fireplace with he had his Academy Award on top of it, and I was just looking at it, and he came over, started talking to me, and, you know, I always thought he was a 5'9" type individual. He's 6'1". And I found myself looking at him. I said, that is a good-looking man, you know, like that. But he was down to earth, and he says, you know, he says, I want you guys to stay in one of my places there, our you know, cabins that we have there. All I ask is you sign into the book. I said, okay. So I went up there myself, and I forget who was with me. I don't know if it was Bo or Don. But anyway, we're in there, and I got the book, and I signed up. It was Barbara Streisand, Willie Nelson, and I put Tony Melendez, Wickenburg, Arizona, you know, and put that up there because I know people say, who's this guy? But I mean, just those experiences like that. And then when Governor Babbitt was, you know, end of his term, after two terms, I knew that I needed to get back into law enforcement. And he says, you know, I says, I want to go back in to law enforcement, you know, because I was still with the Department of Public Safety. And then I went and I said, I want to go back on the freeway as a motor sergeant. And I want to just have it coming at me, because I want to get back into it, really immerse myself in it. And I did. I went back, and it was, believe me, it was a heck of a shock from having where, you know, you're checking in, get on there, says, this is my badge number, 945. Yes, ma'am, I'll be checking on. I'm en route to Washington, D.C., you know, and everybody, I could hear everybody saying things, you know, over the radio. Now I'm stuck on the ditch working that. And I did that for 5 years as a motor sergeant. And also that's when I started working on my administrative stuff. And then from there, I, you know, did that for that. And then I wanted to get my administrative stuff. Then I became the admin for the Southern Division of the Highway Patrol under Major Gindler. And there, he was really a taskmaster. He showed me how to do staff studies and grants and things like that, how to package and how to present those things there. And so I paid my dues on that one. And then at that same time, I became a hostage negotiator. And then after that, they asked me, because of my prior military and plus the other things that I brought to the table as, you know, survival type stuff, to be in charge of a SWAT team. And I did that. And at that time, I also then moved from Highway Patrol to narcotics as the administrative.
And where was all this happening?
In Phoenix, at DPS. Gotcha. And then I did that, and then I then went full-time SWAT. And then I picked up a liquor squad, which was basically in charge of social gambling, which we had at that time here in Arizona. And then about that time, I started doing more special operations. And my squad was the only lab-certified squad, and that's when the meth started really coming into Arizona. And at that time, it was basically, you know, the bikers and outlaw-type individuals doing that. And we would go, you know, they used to call us the Canary Squad because we used to go in there first without any breathing apparatuses. And then we'd secure the scene, then the rest of the officers would come in there secured, and they'd say, okay, is the Canary Squad been in there? Yeah, they're still alive. Okay, it's safe for us to go in there. So anyway, that's when we started, you know, putting our breathing apparatuses, and we had our blood checked, and, you know, that's things that I came up with, saying that we need to have our blood checked to make sure that we're not exposed to any hazardous chemicals and things like that. Did that, and then about that same time, I was sent to the DEA task force as the operational supervisor, and I was in charge of about a 19-man unit, officers, or you know, agents, both female and male, and from, you know, we had Phoenix PD, DEA officers, customs, and all we did was work some street dope, but basically we targeted South America cocaine. I had an Emerald Clipper, which was went after the aircrafts that the smugglers were using, and seizing that stuff and working that round, because at that time 80% of the cocaine was coming from Colombia, and we started working that detail, and that was, to me, you know, a great job. And all my jobs I have with DPS were fantastic. And then from there, I went to, one of my officers was killed in a 10-pound meth buy bus. And I had taken that night off, and I was going to go to the mall with my wife and my daughter, Lindsay, at the time. And, you know, red siren or whistles and sirens were going off, should have been going off in everybody's head, but it wasn't, because at that time, Hispanics weren't doing meth. You know, to me, it just didn't make sense that, you know, they'd be selling it. That I said, it has to be a rip. And one thing, and I think we're deviating from what we're talking here, but it was just didn't make sense because they did not have that, you know, that capability with meth at that time, that they wanted us to show our money. And that's what the dance was. You know, they'd show the dope, we'd show the money, and then we'd exchange. But the rule is that you never had both of them at the same location. And at that time, they flashed the money, and the money stayed there. And the perimeter stayed out, and one undercover officer was inside with two informants and three bad guys. And they went inside. And they said, we got to call our guy. And when they got Richard inside, they said, no, you got to tell your guy with the money to come in here, because it's a rip. And Rich did it and put up a fight. He was killed, and the other individuals got away, but they were able to catch all of them except for the one that controlled it from a distance. And then that was it. So that, about that time, I said, you know, it's time for me to do something else. I said, I'm about that time. And about that time, they said, hey, Wickenburg needs a chief. You want to come out there as an interim? And I said, yeah, I need a break. So I came out here because it is my hometown. And I thought about retiring and doing this. And no, DPS, you know, there was never a day that I did not enjoy going to work, even my days off. Because, I mean, the things that I was very fortunate with my career, it was just totally exciting. And plus, my family was very supportive. My daughter, bless her heart, I remember going on SWAT calls. I was on her birthday, and they're all dressed in little hula skirts. And she would put all these things, and she'd give me like this, you know, good luck bandages, and she'd make these things to protect me. And I said, you know, then I realized that what happens if I'm injured on that day? So then I made a rule that, no, if you have family things going on, you do not go on calls. But anyway, the family went, you know, with me on that stuff. It's time for me to either go into training or do something else. I said, I'll go out to Wickenburg and just take my time with that. And so I came out here, my hometown. I saw everybody again. And it was kind of neat because I knew the town. I knew the council, I knew the, you know, everybody that was, you know, involved with it. And they started dangling that carrot. And I said, you know, did the math. I said, you know. And about that time, too, Linda's parents were here. And, you know, they were getting to that age. And I told Linda, I says, you know, we're going to have to move back to take care of your parents because they've taken care of us. And all my family has gone. And all we have left is your family. So she said, okay, you know, we'll think about that. And I says, I'm going to go to Wickenburg as an interim and do that. Then after a while, they said, you know, you want the job, it's yours, and this other stuff. And so driving out here, I thought, am I ready to go back to Wickenburg? And I got right in. I said, yeah, I am, coming back from Lake Pleasant. And so anyway, this is going to be, then they offered me the job. I took, and I thought I'd do this for a couple of years. Then something up, and I ended up 15 years here as the chief.
When did you first come back as the interim chief? What year was that?
1995, June of 95.
Okay.
And then I retired in June of 2010.
Okay. I'd like to backtrack again, and let's talk about your family. How did you meet your wife? And she's from an old Wickenburg family.
Yes, definitely. I was married once before, and that ended in divorce. And I had two children, and that was ended in 74. And then I met Linda Kirkus here in Wickenburg, and then I was a patrolman, and her family was a Kirkus family that I knew Mitch quite well, and then we were married in 1977. We had our child Lindsay in 1984, and she was from Wickenburg also. She went to grade school here, high school here, and just did the same things I did growing up, but a little bit more protective with their dad and the family, you know, and the female aspect of it too. But yes.
I don't know the Kirkus family history. Can you tell me a little bit about
the Kirkus family history? Came at the turn of the century, last century. And they came from Yugoslavia. And it was Mike Kirkus. They lived out at Balkan, which was out of town by Sarah Station, 15 miles out. And they were hard rock miners. And they were part of the Kirkus, the Bodorogas, that family. And in fact, Mitch's mother was a Bodoroga, and she married Mitch's dad. And that is a story in itself, that here he is by himself coming all the way here from Yugoslavia, San Francisco, ended up here as a hard rock miner. And if you go out Constellation, a lot of the roads that are going out towards Abe Lincoln and Monte Cristo and there's other places out there, you'll see where they're built up and all the foundations. That's all his hard work. He was a stone cutter. And that stuff is still there. In fact, Mitch's family's house is, I have a photograph in there of the house, and it's still, the foundation's gone. But there is a cave where Mike, his father, carved into the side of the hard rock in a little wash. And that was their refrigerator. That's where they, you know, put all their meats, things from that. Then you go away from the river or the wash there, up a ways. Mitch took me out there, and there's a, he cut out and made a stone building 10 by 10 with mesquite. And that was a smoker where he would cure me and everything. And Mitch's older sister is buried out there. She died, I think she only lived about 4 months. She's buried out there. And there's a lot of graves out there. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I regret that I didn't ask why or ask that next question, you know, with my grandfather and with Mitch. Because I remember being out there with Mitch, and he was showing me where they had their house and everything. We had a couple of picnics out there with the family and everything. And then Mitch and I were walking around there. And Mitch became my father, no ifs, ands, or buts. He treated me just like a son. And I was very fortunate. In fact, I told everybody in those days, too, that if anything ever happens between Linda and I get the, you know, the parents, you know, because Mitch and Isla were a mother and father to me. And we went out there, and Mitch showed me, he says, there's some graves out here that I'm responsible for, but he didn't share with me that was his sister, you know. And Mitch was a very quiet in man, even talking military stuff, you know, when he was in France and Normandy and all this other stuff there, you know, he held that pretty close. And I would see him, if he did start to talk, he would tear up quite a bit, things like that. So there was a lot of stuff, you know, you just wouldn't push. And so he was talking about those, and he would do the same thing there. So he just showed me, and then going back up, and then finally I found it, then I did some research, and I found the family. And I have a separate book in there of the Kirkuses. And his father was a hard rock miner, and he lived out there at Gold Bar and stuff like that, and their house was there. And then 16 miles into town, and the boys, there was Tommy, Mitch, and Nikki would all walk into town. That was a typical thing to come into town, walk in 16 miles and come back in. And finally, the family moved in when it was time for them to go to school because he wanted to show them how to speak English and all this other things. And Tom, Mike Kirkus had a house. It's still there, the Kirkus house. It was the Wisdom Kirkus house right there on Kirkus Street. And that's where, you know, they were raised there. And in fact, Mitch talks about how they would, on Friday or Saturday nights, they'd build a big fire right there by the center street and put potatoes in there and cook those. And that's what they had. You know, that was their evening, you know, back in those days and that. But yeah. Her family has a lot of history here, you know, and the things, a lot of that stuff there. That's, yes. And I was fortunate that, you know, I think that had I not been in law enforcement, I think my love would have been in U.S. history because, you know, my grandfather was a great storyteller and he would do that. But I mean, he would even act it out. He would go through the stuff, the mules, this and that, and, you know, and a lot of that stuff. And Mitch had a lot of stories, too, that him and I would share when we'd go to these different camps and hunting trips and things like that.
Can you tell me one? Remember any?
Well, just the different things that, you know, he would, you know, the thing, you know, talked about the potato one that they would make on that aspect of it too. He would go up by Monta Vista. There's a road going up there by, it used to be the Slash Bar Cave, but now it's name of the rehab place out there. Drawing a blank on it right now. Right there, anywhere Dr. Thomas's house is and everything right there. There's a hill going up there. That's the new highway. The old highway goes up on the other side there, where it's actually the driveway to Dr. Thomas's house, and there's some houses there. And it's a steep climb, and he remembers going there, and this is probably when he was maybe 12, you know, 15 years old, and they'd sit there during the day when they weren't in school and wait for the trucks to come, especially the trucks with watermelons. and they'd help push those trucks up that hill, get up there. And, of course, they would get a couple of watermelons for their reward. But that's what they would do, that they would help these trucks, and these older trucks, you know, these 1930-type trucks that couldn't climb that thing there, that him and his kids could come up and do that, you know, and push that up there. My grandfather has a similar story that they used to do, and Mitch would do it too. They would, right out here where the Bronze, well, the Chevrolet Jones was Ford is now there. It used to be, I worked there in high school as Fig and Chevrolet. But anyway, there used to be a place called, they used to call it Tortilla Flats back in the old days. And there's still some, my grandparents on my mother's side lived back in that area. And they would come up there, and the wild burros would come down, and they'd water, and the hacienda would have different pockets of water. And Joe T. and Mitch used to do it too, would wait for them in the evening to come down to water. And the burros would drink so much that they would run after them, and they were so heavy, and they had such small hooves, and in that deep sand, they couldn't run. They'd grab them by their tail, but they'd wait for them to fill up with water first, and then we'd get them, and then they would go sell them. And that's how they would make, you know, additional income back. And Mitch used to do the same thing too. You know, so, yeah, just, you know, but in those days, that's what you did. I remember myself thinking when the hacienda would run. I mean, it would literally run. And we'd jump up on it on a log and float all the way down and not even think. I mean, the water, I remember it was brown and foamy and everything, but we didn't care. We just go down river, get off, and come back. We'd go out to Lake Palm Lake, which is the reserve now, and that was there. It was a lake there called Palm Lake, and we went out there. It used to be the Garden of Olive or something like that, and we'd go during the day, and that was another activity we'd do on the weekend. We'd go up there, and then, you know, we'd walk up river, get in there. Then if we didn't feel like walking back, we'd go on the highway and hitchhike, and they'd bring us into town. And it would be people that we knew. You know, I mean, I know Roy Sandcoxwell picked us up a couple times, you know, brought us in, you know. So, yeah, that's things we used to do.
Do you remember the buildings at the old Garden of Allah?
Yeah, I remember there was I don't know if it's been years. There used to be like a two-story house there that had some stairs going up to the top there. I remember that one. And there was the other thing I remembered about that, there was a lot of quicksand there. And you'd walk and you could feel, even now, going towards where the pond was, you could feel yourself sinking. And it wasn't like mud, it was just, you could see, it was just giving, you know, something just like a trampling. It really felt weird walking out there.
Wow.
And it was a pity that, you know, obviously there's a reason for them to, you know, put the fence and block that all off there. It gave, you know, us access, or denied us access to go up there. Mm-hmm. But I can understand why.
Yeah.
But that's what we used to do when I was a kid. I mean, we'd walk from right there where the underpass is all the way out to, you know, where Morristown is, where up there, San Dominguez, where there's a train bridge there. We'd walk all the way out there, go play, and just walk back in the day. And not even think about it. That's what we did.
You know, another big aspect of Wickenburg's past is rodeo. Did you ever go to the rodeos that were held in town?
No, not really. The rodeo aspect, Gold Rush Days are the biggest mm-hmm. thing there. But in our days, you know, they would have like where the hospital is now. There's a couple of churches out there. That was all empty lot right there. And I know that sometimes they'd have reenactments of the Stagecoach Massacre, and they'd have some of the high school kids. George Gould and them would dress up like wild Indians, and they'd ride, and you know, and they'd have the girl. In those days too, it was almost a rite of passage for the schoolgirls. I remember in the fourth grade, the fifth grade, all the way through grade school, that during Gold Rush Day, they would wear those outfits with the bonnets and the long dresses. That's everybody wore those, you know, on that, and so. That's when they'd have those, you know, reenactments out there. And I remember going out to the various rodeos and seeing that, and going out there by, if you go outside of town right there where the first roundabout is by Vulture Mine, mm-hmm. or not Vulture, by Monta Vista, mm-hmm. there's there, and there's that big field down there. There's still cottonwood trees there, but there used to be two huge cottonwoods. My grandfather's family's house was there, you know, and that's where he grew up, in that area there. And, you know, we'd go out there and, you know, just look around And you know, it's just it's just a different thing. We'd walk all the way. I mean, we'd go out Constellation all the way as far as we could. You know, sometimes we'd always even turn back and go into Box Canyon. We'd walk out of town to Box Canyon, which was not unusual. There was right outside of town here. It wasn't even outside of town. Right now, where they have a Saltwash Bridge and they have that rodeo arena, that used to be nothing but a mesquite thicket. And through there, and we used to refer to it lovingly as the bum's jungle. Because in those days, you know, in the 50s, people would travel the trains. And they'd set up camp down there, and you could see where their camps were. And that's why we always sort of skirted around there so we wouldn't, you know, afraid of bums. But you'd go up there, and there's a place called Sand Hill that's still there. And we'd go up there, and we'd play on the, and that's when the sand was really soft up there. We'd jump off the side of the cliff there into the sand and go play there all day and then come through bum's jungle. And walk, you know, go through there. But in those days, I think my generation was the last generation too that understood. You still go out to Simpsons on the backside, but Wickenburg, especially my granddad's day, was nothing but mesquite thickets all over the place. But what happened, especially at Martinez and the Hacienda, because that's where they put the first mill processing for the Vulture Mine, and the woodcutters cut all that stuff down. And yeah, it's coming back, but yeah, all the mesquites and everything.
Did you ever cultivate the beans?
No, definitely. That grandfather said, "No, don't mess around with that stuff there." You know, we'd have the nopales, the that type of stuff. He knew about the cottontails. You know, when you should get them, get them in the months that have R in them. And, you know, just different things like that.
What's that? What does that mean?
Because a lot of them would get worms. And so you always check that out and not to do that. Quail, the thing about quail, I remember going out where the rodeo arena, Bowman's Rodeo Arena is now on Constellation, make that first bend there. I remember when I first came back from, even as late as 1970, you'd get out there and walk, and that hill would just seem like it was moving with quail. Just moving with quail and all that area. In those days, too, they would show us to say, you don't shoot until they group up. That way, you would save your shells. And it was not unusual to get, three or four birds in one shot. But that was the other thing that, we lived. And then also the hunting for deer. You know, all that stuff was always, part of the things that we did during the season. Mm-hmm. And those, once again, those are other activities we did. Growing up, and then of course going out to the different ponds for dove, so there was always something going that aspect of it, but it was always that outdoor stuff, and much less learning how to bury meat and how to cook it, things like that, working with Dutch ovens, the whole shot there.
So you didn't do much of that, or you did?
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow.
All of that, in fact.
You know how to make Dutch oven biscuits?
Oh yeah, do that. And I mean, my father-in-law Mitch was a pro at that stuff. In fact, I still have all his Dutch ovens that he gave me, and they're the 16, and these are his father's Dutch ovens, so these are well over 125 years old, and I mean, I just, it's an art, and I still have, in fact, on the side of my house here, I built a thing just for wood, and that's what I cook on that part. I'm on this other, I've been here since 98, it's always continuous work as to what I'm doing. This is gas propane on this side, and that's hardwood on this other stuff there, doing that, and I have to pass that on to my grandkids. Because if not, it's a lost art, and not only that, you just can't let those Dutch ovens go away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, especially as old as they are.
Are your kids and grandkids here in Wickenburg?
No, my son and my daughter Misty, who I lost in 2011. Oh, yeah, lost her to melanoma cancer. But anyway, lost her and. Yeah, and then my son Christopher was born here too. He went in with the Highway Patrol, DPS, spent a career with them. In fact, it's a story that when he was getting ready to go to college, he says, "Dad, I don't want to go to college right now because I think I'll be wasting your money." I says, "Well, what do you want to do?" He says, "I want to do what you do." I said, "Okay." And at that time, DPS had what they called an officer trainee, where they took him at 18, and they prepared him for the academy. So when they turned 21, they go to the academy. At 18, he had to go through the whole process of, hiring and all this other thing. It's just like a regular patrol patrol officer. So anyway, long story short, he became a police officer. He even took over my old SWAT team, and he became that. He retired after 20 years. Now he's teaching tactical operations out of Vegas for a company that specializes in teaching military operations and the special forces type units, all that tactical stuff. And he travels all over the country and world doing that. So he's enjoying the heck out of that. And then Lindsay is in Peoria. She graduated here out of high school and went to college. And then she's out of Peoria selling real estate. And her two boys, you know, my son had two girls. Misty had a boy, and they were in Illinois. Then when I retired in 2010, my daughter, Lindsay, had two boys, Cash and Kingston. And I told her, I'm taking ownership of those boys. And which is great, you know, because I became a babysitter. And to me, that's just where I enjoy probably about 3 or 4 days of my week doing it with them. So, and showing them the desert and telling them the stories that my grandfather told me. And they can tell you about, you know, my grandfather's brother, Vitola. They'll know the stories. And then for say those names, and I can show them, just like the other day, taking them on the same exact route that my grandfather's father would take the mules out to Vulture Mine, the wagon trains, and taking them on that same exact road and showing them that. And I'm trying to instill in them that what you're saying here is the same thing your great-grandfathers and mothers saw, and not only on my side of the family, but on your grandma's side of the family. Mm-hmm. And that's the part about, you know, Linda says, you think we'll ever move from Wickenburg? I said, no. I says, you know, I'm the last one. You're the last one of the family that's here, you know. And to lose that, you know, is very sad to me, yeah. You know, because there is a lot of history, and I mean, of Wickenburg in here.
Yeah. You know. I'm glad you mentioned that about it's your great-grandfather, Ocampo. There's a photo of him in his water trucks.
No,
I believe,
yeah.
Tell me that story. And tell
well,
me that
was the thing that, you know, that my grandfather would tell me back there. And my grandfather, like I said, was a great storyteller. He died when he was 92, and he was born here in 1898. And he at that time when he passed, he was, in fact, from about 80 years old, he was the oldest living native of Wickenburg. And so, therefore, his stories. And then I was able to verify him because he told me a story about an individual that had, you know, give you an example, that had his arm caught in a straw outside of by Vulture Mine, and he stayed out there for 3 days. Finally, they had to cut his arm off because it's so bad. Because what happened is his arm got stuck in there, and the mule kept on pressing. And finally, he passed out. They had to amputate him. And he had told me a story about him and that individual out of Vulture Mine, what they used to do. And Joe T would go by there and see him. Like he would take his on the wagon coming into town. They'd go right by the grade school. And at that time, he was 16, so he'd like to show off, he said. So right with the school girls out there, he'd be riding the mules in, you know, the trains and everything, come back doing that. Then plus tell me about, you know, his girlfriends and things like that. Well, this individual showed up right before I went into service. This was probably 67, 68. And he starts verifying the stories. And plus his arm's gone, you know. So I said, okay. It's all there. Then all these other stories he's telling me that it's factual. And that's what Joe T used to say. There's a lot of stuff that's in Wickenburg that they say, but I'm not going to say anything because that's what they believe, so I'm going to leave it alone. But he knew, I mean, he you know, from his parents, like, you know, back in the day, Wickenburg was, there's a adobe wall all the way around it, you know, because of the Indians. And, you know, just the amazing things that they went through, you know, and the different things and the stores that are still there, just like the Texas Cafe, which is now the two-story building where they have the antiques and everything going out of town by the roundabout. The Princess is still there. I have photographs that show the Princess as they're taking their team out. Jack Fisher is the individual in that they, you know, and that's a, you know, they say these things, and I said, I'm not going to say anything, but they should. In fact,
I think I know what photo you're talking about because it's in my book. Uh-huh. And everybody says it's Joe Ocampo, right?
Yeah. They say it's one of these two here. Oh, there's another one here I want to show you too. But
we're now looking at the Wickenburg Images of America book written by Lynn Downey.
Oh, no.
And now we're looking at the...
No, let me find the book for you
right
here.
Right side. We're looking at a bunch of books.
Hang on a second. I'll find this right now. Oh, it's that one right there.
This is The Town on the Hasa Yampa.
Yeah. I think that's the one that, let's see. I was looking at these today. Right here, this individual right here.
I've seen this photo, and it says, water wagon belonged to Jose Ocampo, departing for the Vulture Mine from Front Street near the Hacienda River. So that's not true.
No, that is Jack Fisher.
Jack Fisher.
Part of, you know, see, they take the whole supplies out there. They take the big wagons, they take the water wagons, and they take, my grandfather took at that, because he was the youngest, he would take the hay and everything to feed the mules and the horses. And they'd always come out of where the variety store is. That was Charlie Hyder's stables, and that's who he worked for. In that actual picture, they're going out Constellation, not Vulture Mine, because if you look at that, you can see the Princess and the Texas Cafe are still there. And those were the things. And the reason, you know, you see that. And I'll show you something here real quick. This is my grandfather's. One thing that we did get more than anything else is that he, you know, he gave me his old photographs. And these are the photographs that he had. This is obviously the old. But these are the ones that... just like right here. These are the original ones that he had.
Oh, there it is. Mm-hmm. Jack Fisher.
Yeah. And this is my grandfather coming up behind him. And there's the Princess, there's the Texas Cafe.
Okay.
And they're coming up, then they're coming right into the Hacienda.
So this is where the roundabout is, right here?
Yeah, off to the
yeah,
side
right
here.
Over
yeah.
Here. Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
So here is
this is my grandfather, Joe Tio Campo.
Okay.
And he's following back here. Mm-hmm. And
he was carrying the hay and everything for the animals at the Vulture?
Yes, definitely. Because here's the other part of the... His brothers were doing this other part. They'd come with the big wagons.
Oh, okay.
Wow. They would all be coming. And these are the original photographs that he gave me. And so, when you see something like that, it's, I'm going to bite my tongue and not say anything. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that Joe T. would show me. And, there was one here that I wanted to show you. I mean, away from this thing. Right here.
Uh-huh.
That's Henry Wickenburg.
Uh-huh.
And you see that tree? That mesquite right there?
Uh-huh.
That's where they found his body. That is still there. And that location is right there at Google's. And Google's is where the house used to be. That's where Henry Wickenburg's house used to be.
Okay.
And that's the dilemma that I get into by saying what they're saying is this
the Etter house. They're saying this is the Etter house.
But those were the people that took these people
right.
That took care of him.
Uh-huh.
And this is where they found him right here. And if you go out there's still a rock there where they found his body.
So yeah. Where and how are you spelling his Google name? It's
G-U-G-L-E. Yeah, but it's you know, they're no longer there. And you know, it's along the road, and you know, maybe one of these days that you know we can, I can take you and I can just show you that. And the other thing too is you can still see, you know, where his fields were. You know, that's the back part of the thing there. Now here's, if you go like, say for instance, I'm not going to mark up on this one,
you can mark that one.
But this location is right here. The old high school's right there, and there's a big field here, and that's what it used to be, his fields, and that's what got washed away.
Mm-hmm.
His place is there. The railroad tracks come up here. The Google house was right here, and that's where his house was.
Okay.
And right behind the tracks, there was a cave where he could go in and hide.
I was going to ask about that. It's a tunnel house.
Yeah, and that's where it was back there. They finally had to box it off because we would go in there and do that. And the other is right here by Woody's tanks, by the railroad tracks.
Okay, so where was the Google, where's the tree in the Google house?
Right here.
Okay.
And this is the Google house right there.
Okay. So
and this is Tegner. This is going down to Simpsons.
Okay.
And if you go down, this is the high school, the old high school thing, and the fields right there. And right here, there's a pasture, and there's remember those apartments right there?
Yeah.
You go past that, there's a wash that you come up, you go under that wash, and then there's a driveway that goes around like a horseshoe. The Google house is right here. Then there's a couple of houses here. Tony Orozco's house used to be right here, but right here is that tree.
Wow.
And there's, once again, all that was old mesquite thickets in through there. And I remember going, this tree finally fell down here. But we used to go to Google's and, you know, even right before I went to Vietnam, I was there. You know, we were having a going away party.
Oh,
uh-huh. like that. But wow. yeah, right there that's, in that location.
Okay.
And if you come up here, you're going to see a mesquite tree and you're going to see a big rock and you wonder, what's that rock doing there? That's where it was.
I'm going to go look for it. If I can't find it, you and I are taking a field
trip.
Tell me about the tunnel house. What was that like?
It was just a, you know, a rock house. You know, it was almost like a storage house. I think it was on the side of the it'd be on the south side of the tracks. And we'd go up there, right, the wash was to the left, or stage right if you're looking at it, you know, or stage left, I forget which one you want to do. But there might be some, in fact, I was going to go there the other day to see if I could find that place there. Because right behind that, too, is right up here is where he's buried.
Right.
Right there. And then also, his grave up there, and there's the other ones there. There used to be, on Washington Street, used to be a cemetery there. And that's where they buried the people that were in the massacre. And that's where he said, you know, and then right before he killed himself, he told people, I need you to take care of these people because they died with their boots on, which meant these are the ones, that there were six of them that died with their boots on. And that part there, it was in a book that I saw one time too, and I can't find that book. And it was there because it was the same book that had stories of Henry Wickenburg walking or going all the way back up to Prescott for jury duty and things like that, that he was a hard-nosed individual, you know. And
I want to talk to you about the massacre when we're done. Mm-hmm. was the tunnel house, was it dirt or was it stone on the inside?
It was stone, a combination of stone, dirt, and everything back
there.
Were
there any, like, wooden supports or anything?
No wooden supports. There might have been some mesquite branches and things up on top on that part. You know, and they say, you know, in the, that he would go up there to escape from, you know, that he could tunnel escape from the Indians and stuff like that. I think basically it was just to get back in there and, you know, fortify himself. Plus, I think that's where they could put this storage stuff. You know, that's what they used to do, you know, put hay and rocks and carve into that.
I found an old newspaper article, and the reporter actually went to that house and talked about it being wonderfully cool and looked like a real house mm-hmm. on the inside. It was always cool all year long.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is that the Google House, it's still, most of it is adobe, those three-foot walls up through there. And that was part of it. They've added on to it. But you go up there, and it's still, you know, the house.
Yeah.
And that's where my grandfather would say, that was his house. That's where it was at, mm-hmm. and things like that. And then I find these other magazines like, you know, where are they? I had some stuff here, like this one here. You know, things that my grandfather, when you think about his storytelling and the things he would talk about, like he was talking about when President Taft came up here, when it came to state and stuff like that, and he's talking about how he came in there, they got the school kids there, and they taught him to say, you know, what was it? Arizona, zip, boom, bay. 48th state in the USA. They taught the school kids how to say that. And then he says things like this. Two little girls came up and he names them. That he, you know, that's the way he was. He knew the names, the whole shot there. They gave him a canteen with Hacienda water in it. And they told him, if you ever drink from it. And he says, he actually drank. He says, yep, he drank from it and stuff like that. And you know, just the stories that he would tell. And they were factual, you know. And then, you know, talk about the school days and things like that. And that's just one of the things there. And a couple of these other magazines, they would interview them. And I know a couple of other reporters came back in. And the stuff I remember I told, I forget who the individual was that was doing, that did a play, a reference, my grandfather, the storyline about going out to Vulture Mine, taking 3 days, and they'd stop at Poquet Tank. Then go the next day into the mine, come back, stop at Poquet Tank, and then come back in. And that's when they would talk about ghost stories and things like that. And that was the big thing that, you know, they used to talk about in those days, is the ghost stories.
Oh, what was the name of the tank? What is it?
Poquet Tank.
Q-U-E-T-T-E. Okay. Do you remember any of the ghost stories?
No, they'd always talk about a lot of them. One of the ghost stories, they'd always say that, my grandfather says that, his father was coming, that you didn't go out of town at night. You were in-house. You never gone out at night because that's when you'd see all these aberrations and all this other things there. He says his father had to get home, and he was going out by Saul's Wash, and he was getting ready to go underneath or the wash there. when this dog appeared, and it was like a bulldog, he says, with its eyes were on fire, looking at him, growling, and the horse froze, and he jumped off the horse and ran back in. That's the story he tells. Then they talk about where his house was, his father's house. In fact, there's a photograph of his father and his family in one of my, it's in this book, right? No, it's in this book right here. There's a photograph of my grandfather in there with the family. And that house was there. And in fact, I saw it there when I was in high school as a junior. And after that, you know, they knocked it down. But that area where the police station is and the library and stuff like that was all mesquite. And there used to be a graveyard there. In fact, there was, you know, when they built that parking lot and everything, I think they probably dug up a few graveyards. But no, they just kept on going there. But that used to be a graveyard there.
And where was that? I'm sorry.
You know where the lumber yard is?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right across the street. Right there where they had the parking lot, where the train used to be. That was an old graveyard there. And it says, in fact, excuse me, I think they said that, you know, that somebody mentioned that when they were putting that in, and I was gone at the time when they were doing that, that they found, you know, some graves there. They just kept on going, but that was an old graveyard. But the story goes back that there was a headless man walking around there, that his head was cut off by the Indians, and they would do that. And you know, he says, that's all they did. He says, maybe because we were, maybe, you know, not ignorant, but it just in those days, that's all he talked about is the latest story that they couldn't explain things. You know, it, to them, it was so unusual. They talked about, another example about how confused they were. He says, I remember, he says, at the Alper House, it was facing Tegner Street, and they had a guy going around town saying they're going to have a motion picture. They didn't know what the heck that was. Come see this motion. And they kept on doing that. He says they went there and they had everybody came up there, all the old people and the whole shot. And that must have been probably, 1910, 1912, around that area. And they had that. He says, and they have the guy setting up the projector. And he says, and everybody's turned around and look at the guy with the projector. And he's trying to tell them, you got to look that way. They're saying, no, that's right there. They're all looking. He can't get them to turn around. He says, and they won't turn around. He says, but then as soon as he says, okay, turn it on. About that time, he says, everybody was breaking their neck to turn around to see what it was. And he says it was he says, I remember it was about this train and this hobo, and he started a hay thing on fire. And I saw that one time on television as an old silent movie of a hobo on a train. And so that was the movie that they were showing at that time there. But little things like that, you know, Princess was a great place that they would go to play dominoes and things like that. And that's where they would tell the stories about what they saw and all this other things there. You know, so those were the times. He says the other thing, too, is that they would go to Congress for entertainment. They'd ride out there because that's where the big dances were in Congress. In those days, Congress had, you know, a couple thousand people up there. And it's, you know, spend the night there and come back in and everything. And he says, and of course, my grandfather was a romantic. He's, oh, so beautiful, Tony. So beautiful. At night, you'd be laying there. And then pretty soon, here comes the orchestra. And they come out and they serenade the different, you know, girls and like that. He says, oh, it was so beautiful. Just sit there at night and listen to them serenading, you know, and everybody. And he says, in those days, everybody spoke Spanish. I mean, his good friend, Garland, spoke beautiful Spanish, and he came up, and he was an older man at that time. This was probably 1965. His daughter brought him over, and it was my grandfather's best friend, and they were just sat there just talking, you know, Spanish the whole shot there. He said, but everybody spoke in those days.
When you were growing up, that was everybody in town?
No, not really. No. See, because my generation, because my parents were not allowed to speak Spanish. They said, you're speaking English. And they smacked their hands. They said, my grandfather said the same thing too. Nope, can't do that. And so therefore, we were, you know I spoke a lot of Spanish till I was about 3 or 4 or 5. And then after that, converted over. And I still have a little bit, but not like I, you know, should have. And so therefore, you know, and that was because they didn't want us to be punished for speaking Spanish. And that was their generation that came through that on that part there. So, yeah. But in my, you know, coming up, there was no, everybody spoke English. And, you know, and there was no, you know, I didn't know anything about the different race aspect until I went to California my freshman year. I said, whoa, there is something going on here. And that was, you know, I said, I want to go back to Wickenburg, you know. So that was that part.
So do you think your parents and grandparents were sort of penalized for speaking Spanish, or they weren't allowed to speak Spanish?
Yeah, and that's, you know, especially like my mom and her generation, that was, you know, that because they spoke Spanish. They said, no, you can't speak that. You have to do that. So therefore, she says, when you guys are going to school, we wanted to make sure that, you know, you weren't going to be put through that.
So, oh, that's interesting.
And the other thing too, I used to be a lefty, and my grandfather said, "Nope, you can't do that. You got to be a righty." And my mother was a lefty, and she had to go through that same thing, but she still maintained her lefty. And then my grandson Kinky now is a lefty, and my son is a lefty. So I said, "No, you're going to be a lefty." You know.
So you never were a lefty.
Well, I still do a lot of stuff left-handed. I'm, you know, if I shoot a rifle, kick a football, and that's where I get confused. The golf. What do I? You know, which one? I can bat right-handed, but you know, I'm still. Can do a lot of stuff left. And my dominant eye is left, you know, so.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I think we're about done. Let me see.
I know we sort of went.
No, it's okay. That's good. That's how people talk to each other. That's all right.
Uh-huh.
If somebody was going to, they were thinking about moving to Wickenburg.
Uh-huh.
And you, what would you tell them about why it would be a good idea for them to move to Wickenburg?
I think, you know, the thing is that what I like about Wickenburg now is that it's, you know, unique in itself. You know, Wickenburg is a bedroom community. It's always going to be that way. Wickenburg is the fourth oldest. Also, you think about, Wickenburg was controlled in its growth, you know, in the early days. You know, a lot of people used to say in the early days, like, you know, my grandfather's parents, that Wickenburg was a throwback to Mexico, you know, sort of lazy and, you know, everybody took a nap and that kind of stuff there. The other big thing about Wickenburg in those days, too, is we had a lot of standing water. And there was a lot of sickness. There was, you know, malaria and that stuff because of the mosquitoes and things like that. And so once they started getting rid of the water aspect of it, too, and keeping the standing water moving or away, that did that. So that was the other thing that they did. And also, it started perking up. And, in fact, you know, where McLennan School is, or the Catholics, or yeah, the Christian school now is right there. In my grandfather's days when he was a kid, he would deliver milk there, and it was a tuberculosis center where they'd bring everybody that had tuberculosis there, and he would say, you know, so you know, that's where, you know, he remembers that quite well, but that was the main thing about Wickenburg in those days. It was unhealthy because of that and the mosquitoes and the standing water, but. In Wickenburg's growth, I think a lot of people wanted to keep it that way, especially during the Dude Ranch days, you know, where everybody would come into town, the bars would do well, and everybody was structured back in there. And it was a controlled environment, and it always has been, you know, it's been controlled. Been people outside of the town of Wickenburg that buy, you know, buy their acreage and everything. And I think that's where we got to think about it. Now we have a lot of growth, and a lot of people come in, and they have their ideas of how Wickenburg should be, you know, which might not be the same way I think it should be, you know, that, you know, you need to have this, and maybe a Walmart, and do this other stuff there, but it's right there. The other thing, though, is that it's all coming to us, as it is anyway, and it's just going to be a matter of time before, you know, right now, surprises at Whitman, pretty soon it'll be at Morristown. You know, they kept on thinking that we needed to get out to Morristown for that intersection, because that's where the money's going to be for the town. But no, the town will have to survive the way it's going to survive with itself. But I don't think it's, you know, it's not meant to be that way. It's a bedroom community, and we keep it that way. And it's going to be interesting with this new development, which I don't think is really going to take off.
Which one is that?
The new Wickenburg Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Out on 93.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a while before they envision their 2,500 homes out there, you know. Yeah, which they say will double Wickenburg's population. But when I was chief of police here, the argument that I would get into, or I should say discussion with the town, is that you had me at a disadvantage because you say that Wickenburg's population is 6,000, maybe 9,000, but that, and then also we have an additional 10,000 outside of it, but they use the town. And additionally, we have a daytime population with a traveling motor public. Right now, there's probably about 10 million cars come through Wickenburg a year. At the 18, you know, at my time, when I was the chief, they had 7 million cars coming through. I said, that's my daytime population. that we have to deal with that. You know, if they have anything, wreck or whatever, or an accident, we have to take responsibility. I says, as a police department, I was having a hard time because the rule of thumb is you should have one officer for every 1,000 people. And that's 24, another, you know, three officers a day for just that. So actuality on duty, and sometimes I would only have two or three officers if I was lucky. And not only that, my booking was in Phoenix. And then the other one we got, Yavapai County, of course they moved it, was in Camp Verde. So if an officer made an arrest, that's where we would go. But Wickenburg is meant to be small. And we also have a natural barrier with our mountains. And I think if we just maintain that and not worry about the outer perimeter and just keep it that way. And this weather is to die for. You know, this is what they pay the big bucks for. And I think that's the idea, that we just can maintain that aspect of it too. You know, my wife says, I'd like to move into town with the family. And that way we can take the boys out on to the park. I says, hey, we have the park here, you know. Not only that, besides it's family, and the boys love coming out here. And I think that's what, it's a family-orientated community, and that's the way it should be. And it's always been that way. And I think that's why, you know, and there's, I take ownership of Wickenburg, I really do, because of my family history. And, you know, I remember, I mean, I went through all of it. You know, I remember as a highway patrolman here, when US 60 was the only way to go. And, you know, it was not unusual for us to have 20 to 30 stops per shift, which was a lot for highway patrol. And I mean, just, it was going crazy, you know. And especially on the weekends, we just pull off to the side there and wait for an accident call because traffic was so heavy and coming through town. And then when the Brenda cutoff came in, it became a ghost town. You know, there was no traffic. And then, you know, I went through that and I saw that, and everybody was worried about, you know, the new highway and stuff like that. It's not going to happen. And Wickenburg will maintain itself. It's meant to be that way. You know, we're an island, if you want to say. That's the way it should be.
Well, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like
no,
to talk about?
No, I think I went here, there, or everywhere, you know. So, but that's me. I'm eclectic, I guess, to doing that type of stuff there, because my life is so intertwined with Wickenburg, its history, and the love of I have for this town, plus my family, and the stories and the memories that, you know, my great, 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 great grandparents went through. You know, when my grandfather can say at the cemetery, that is my grandmother, that's my great, great, and that's my great, great grandmother right there. And, you know, on that, and you go to the cemetery and you see that. Of course, as I was a young kid, I'd go up there and I didn't think it. But before he passed, I got my movie camera out there and I videotaped him going through the whole thing, which to me was a gold mine. And I asked him, they said, you know, of everything I have, what do you want? I said, all I want is the pictures. Some of the stuff we lost in the first museum fire, but luckily I had some left over. Mm-hmm. And so we're lucky on that aspect.
Do you still have the videotape of your grandfather?
Yes, I do.
That's
that.
Wonderful.
Yeah, do that. And then, in fact, I showed it to my uncle, his son, for the first time. And he was blown away because he said, you told me, but I just couldn't envision my dad, his right there on the big screen talking and, you know, and telling me where everybody was at. And it was one of those things there. My grandfather was died and I sort of stepped back and let my uncle and, you know, his sons take control. And my brother had some, you know, let them take control of their father. And went to the Garcia Cemetery and says, okay, this is where he's going to be buried. My grandfather, before he passed, he said, I want to be buried right by my father. This is where I'm going to be buried, right here next to my father. And, you know, right next to me, that's a lady that we, you know, we've been taking care of her grave since 1870. And my father's buried here. He died here in 1906. And I'm going to be buried here. Then his other sisters are up here. The youngest one, I think, was in 1881 here. Then plus his grandmothers are over here. And the rest of the Grijalvas and all the family members are there. But he said, I'm going to be buried here. Well, when I got there, they had dug a hole next by the Ocampos on his uncle's side, not his father's side. And he didn't want to be buried there. you know, he just said, I don't want to be buried there. Whatever you do, don't let me. And there he was. And then what could I do? And I just sat there. And I mean, it just bothered me for years. Then finally, about 6 years later, I went and talked to old man Garcia. I says, I know that's vacant there. And he says, yeah, you can put him there. Since it's a private cemetery, we went and dug him up, pulled him up. I had all my good friends come up and help me with that. And it was still intact. We made sure it was secure. We brought it up, dug his hole, put him up there, put him next to his dad. He's there. And I made a DVD of that. I said, now I can rest, Joe T, you're by your dad, you know. And I said, that's what he wanted. And that's what I showed my uncle. Because everybody was saying, no, he wanted to be on this side. That's why those rocks were prepared. I said, no, there's somebody buried there. I said, let me show you something. I showed that to him. And that's Joe T talking. This is where I'm going to be buried. And they said, okay, you're right. I said, so that's what we did
there.
That's
amazing. Yeah. Well, what are some of the other family names out there? Grijalva.
Grijalva, yes. Ocampos. There's another one. Montoya was another one. Had two uncles up there that they died the same year. Two brothers up there. But the Grijalvas is actually, because what had happened is my grandfather's family, the Ocampos came in. And they were working, and they worked various areas. They were teamsters. They hauled, you know, that aspect. And then my grandfather's mother was married to Tiburcio Villa. In 1870, he was killed in La Paz, in Ehrenberg, in that area. And then she came up here with her family. And she had two small children, which was my grandfather's mother and his uncle, Tiburcio Villa. And her name was Navatia Villa. And then she married Grijalva. They had 15 kids, you know. And Grijalva is the one that found a San Dominguez mine, gold mine and everything. And he's the hard rock miner that did all the other stuff there.
I knew that name.
Yeah, and he's buried out there. And that was a funny thing about, you know, being part of the family. You start digging this stuff up there. Because I know one of my distant cousins, she was there talking about the Grijalva. Says, this is my mother, and this is my mother's mother, or this is my mother, and this is, you know, this other stuff there. And they're doing that tour during September Fest. And I says, you mind if I jump in? I says, because not that I want to take over, but you see, this is your mother, but right here, this is your mother's mother. And right over here is your mother's father, your mother's mother's father. You know, and she didn't know who these people were. I said, and they're not marked. I said, so that's my job now to mark them all out and do that. And same with my, the Grijalvas didn't know that my grandfather's mother's is buried there, and her mother's buried there, and her mother's buried there. They're right next to each other. And if you go there, it'll say Jesus Grijalva, and it'll say Jesus Grijalva, and Jesus Grijalva. You know, say, who are they? And that's and you go from right to left on that part there. But that was Joe T showing me that part there. And then everybody had he has a story for everybody, because he knew everybody and said, you know, how they do that. Then his, you know, so that's what I like about going out there and listening to, you know, all the people that had passed there. And so, yeah.
Well, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
This is wonderful.